Hey gang, before the episode, I wanted to let you know, over at the Intensive Care Academy, our other project where we have lots and lots of video courses on critical care, ranging from basic stuff to specialized material, there's tons of content, continuing education credits available. We're going to be running a month-long sale just to try to get the feet in the door. So if you listen to this, it's going to be live, and it's going to be live through the end of the month of April 2026. So if you want 20% off subscriptions, if you've been thinking about it, this would be a great time. Just check out with the code APR26, APR26. It'll give you your discount. Check it out, guys. We'll see you over there. Otherwise, on to the show. Hey everyone, I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world.
Hello everyone, welcome back. It's Brian Bowling with you, and with me as always is my partner in crime, Brandon Odo.
Hello.
We thought we would talk about some interesting kind of different non-clinical stuff today, and it's always a good excuse to get friend of the podcast, Scott Weingart, back on. Scott needs really no introduction. Those of you who have been living under a rock in a cave on Mars, buried up to your eyeballs, Scott is the host of the popular podcast MCRIT, and dealing with all things emergency and critical care. Welcome back to the podcast, Scott.
Always a pleasure.
So, Scott, I'm going to try to capture the large portion of the audience who has no interest in navel-gazing philosophical sorts of topics, which I have some interest in, and I know you do as well. But I think this is relevant to everyone, probably even outside of medicine, but medicine is our interest. And the question at hand is epistemics, which for a philosopher is the study of truth and how we come by knowledge. Epistemology, people will talk about as sort of more of the science and theory of what truth is and, you know, angels dancing on pins and stuff. But you could ask this in a more practical way, like literally how should we know things and know that things are true, which is obviously relevant to all of us, whether or not we care to think about it. And in medicine, I feel like this question has become more and more relevant, although it's, of course, always been, because the traditional model for knowing things is that we get told what to know in school. And that's still much the case, maybe less so now. But even, you know, 100 years ago, once you graduate and finish your training, you still have to address these questions of how do you continue to achieve new knowledge and learn things, unless you just choose to never learn anything again, which I guess is one option. But, you know, the traditional answer to this would be, well, you go to the foundations of truth, the primary, you know, links to the world, which is like the primary literature. You read journals, you see what people have studied scientifically, and that's how you know what's true about the world. But it's become really hard to do this in the modern world because there's so much material published. It's so hard to grapple with it on a practical level, like to really assess the methodology and how the studies were done, and more so. I mean, every time I open a journal now, I'll look at, you know, statistical methods and how the study was structured, and half the time I'm like, I have no idea what that means. There are all these new adaptive models that are no longer the standard ways of conducting studies. More and more, I think of a black box for people. So all they can say is, well, if you say so. And then truthfully, especially in critical care, so often there's just a lack of a definite answer to any real question. So that if you want to, even if you were the world expert in a topic area, oftentimes your idea of truth is just sort of your general sense of where the science is at, kind of where it's leaning, what you think is probably going to turn out to be the areas where things pan out, that kind of thing. It's not like there is an answer out there waiting to be found. So this has all led a lot of people, I think, to asking other sources of truth like experts or AI now. And we should, I think, tackle those in turn. But just to start with the question of journals and the literature. You were at one point some years ago famous for your approach to literature, which was to read like 1,000 journals a month or something. And I think that's of interest mostly because it's not the answer for many people. So I'm curious both how you go about this. How do you try to stay up to date, which you certainly do. I mean, on your podcast, you still do a monthly journal review. And also, frankly, how you think other people should, because those may not be the same. You know, not everybody is Scott Weingart, just as not everybody is Brian or I, although there's probably more Brians and Brandons. But how do you actually do this in your real life these days?
Yeah, I'll happily answer that question. But the proviso is, you've already stated in a only slightly hyperbolic fashion, that what I do is not recommended for most practitioners. And I don't think it probably is even smart for me, but this is what obsession does. So I read, and then the number vacillates, but somewhere around 60 journals a month. And when I say I read them, I don't read them cover to cover, because most of what's in journals is crap. But I'm going to screen the table of contents of 60 journals. Anything that's remotely interesting or relates to my area of expertise and what I care about, which is the first 24 hours of critical care, I'm going to look into a little bit further. And then, you know, I want to stay current in general critical care and general emergency medicine, so I'll read a bunch of that too. And I'll look at the abstracts for those papers. And then if the abstracts don't immediately send up red flags as being useless or too early on the bench research versus actual clinically utile information, then I'm going to read the entire paper. And most of those get screened out as well. And after those, you know, 60 journals worth of screening, you wind up with, I don't know, 8 or 10 papers a month that might have the tiniest little movement of the dial in terms of, will this actually change clinical practice? And a lot of those are not even going to do it, even if they're very good, because they're just a restatement of what we already knew, but now we have more evidence, you know, multi-center validation of things we were already using. So really, all of this work is in service of a very tiny movement of that needle. So should people be doing what I'm doing? Absolutely not. Unless you're going to run a podcast. Like, maybe Brandon and Brian should be doing it.
That's your job, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Or I was doing it before the podcast because I was crazy. And, you know, my entire way of operating is to find a rationale for my obsession rather than simply curing the obsession. So as soon as the podcast came around, my
avenue for your
justify your insanity.
Exactly. So now, like, I'm a crazy completionist. I want to touch everything. And now I have a justification for it. No one calls me crazy anymore. Now they just say it's good business. You don't want to go down that road. So don't read 60 journals a month. Now, there's the Pareto principle. That is the 80-20 rule in so many areas: economics, financial, research. All of it comes down to that 20% of effort yields 80% of the results. And I'd argue in medicine, our Pareto distribution is 90-10 for so many things. Meaning, if you did 10% of the work, you get 90% of the results. And the other 10% of the results you get by doing an additional 9 times the amount of work. So if you applied that to journals, you know, you're talking about somewhere like 10 journals a month. You get the vast majority of whatever benefit I get. Okay, is that reasonable? Probably still not reasonable. That's a lot. Okay, can we reduce it further? I'd say if you were reading, you know, 3 or 4 journals a month simply to stay au courant with what's going on in your field, you'd probably be better than 95% of the people out there. Mm-hmm. So how does that hit you so far?
So by reading, you mean, as you described, sort of a iterative process. Scan the table of contents, see if anything jumps out as of any interest, meaning probably so important that it's of everyone's interest or of particular interest to some interest you have. And then if it seems like maybe, skim the abstract. And then if that kind of, you know, achieves whatever level you have time for, then actually read the article. So exactly. You're not reading every one of these journals, you're looking at them.
Yeah. And look, if we're talking 3 or 4 journals, we're talking an hour a month is really what we're talking about here. You'll probably from those come up with like 1 or 2 papers that you really want to read in depth. And some of them are going to be review papers, which I think are wonderful. You know, in some ways better if they're a well-wrought review than an actual piece of primary research. you're really putting in a very small time commitment for what I think is a huge yield, not just for the individual thing you have learned from those one or two papers, but for continuing building the skills of information literacy to actually stay in the attention span mindset of being able to read a paper, to analyze a paper, to think about a paper. I think that's a skill that's very depletable if not continuously reinforced.
Well, because that's the, I think, next question, because we then have to ask, how deeply are you trying to read these articles? And you could say, well, read it all, try to really understand it, how it was done, whether it applies to, you know, all these things. But there's sort of levels here. And for a lot of people, they're not going to get to the deepest levels because they don't have the time or motivation, mm-hmm. or they don't have the training to really assess all the nitty-gritty components of the statistics and how this embeds itself into the existing literature and sort of how it moves the, you know, the Bayesian probabilities and stuff. And then you could argue, well, if you can't do that, then why not just read the abstract? Just read their conclusions. Because if you're basically going to take their word for what they found, then why not just do that?
Sure. No, it's a great question. First of all, abstracts lie. And arguably, if you find a paper that's you think is going to be utile to your practice, don't read the abstract, don't read the discussion, just read the methods and the results is what we would tell people. Now, obviously, don't actually do that, but it's just to get across the idea that the abstract is a construction that's not necessarily helpful. The discussion is really a review paper within a piece of primary research, not particularly helpful, except, you know, sometimes you get insights into what the authors were thinking. But really what you want is the methods and the results to really decide if this is going to be helpful for your practice. Now, you brought up a good point, especially with our current crop of primary research. Oftentimes we don't have the skill set to really know, is this truth or not, to get back to epistemology. And I'll tell you, I thought I was going to have as a major niche in my career, evidence-based medicine. I wrote a book on it. I studied it extensively. I don't feel qualified to analyze the current crop of primary research. And that's fine, because you're not reading it for that necessarily. And in fact, I'd say there needs to be an additional step if you find a paper that you think, huh, this could change my clinical practice, is you really want to vet it with someone who has that methodological expertise. And that's not me. You know, some of my brethren are the people I'd go to and say, you know, does this hold up? The reason you're reading it is, first of all, you might have clinical subject matter expertise. And sometimes the researchers lack that. We could talk about examples of papers where, you know, millions of dollars have been spent. And like, if they had just asked a clinical subject matter expert, they would have told you the study in its current form is never going to yield real results because you've left out a critical piece of clinical expertise that's going to invalidate the entire trial. But the real thing you're reading it for is generalizability. And that is the one question any practitioner can answer is, as you're reading this, is this applicable to my practice? Because even if something sounds great, and then you look at it and you're like, we can never do that right now, then it's not really worth indulging all of the time it takes to decide, is this a good paper? Is this practice changing? Unless you say it's not generalizable right now, but I think if I argued with our clinical nurse director and we got people on board, then we can make it. And that's another reason to read it. But you're looking at it from the perspective of, is there something on offer here? Is that something on offer actually going to be useful in my practice environment? And you're the only one who can make that decision.
Generalizable sounds like a very lofty term, but what it's actually, it's very, very personal. You're saying, is this relevant to me? And no one, that's not general. I mean, it might not be relevant to somebody else, but is it relevant to my patients and my practice? And really questions that I have, which no one else knows what your questions are. Where are your own areas of equipoise or where you could see, you know, your practice being changed? And like you said, that's the authors don't even know that. They may have different questions or a different idea of how applicable it is to people. And then the question of whether the structure and rigor of the study supports that conclusion is a different one. I mean, it could be that you say, oh, this seems very relevant. And then you go to your stats guy and he's like, I don't think this is, it's like having your house inspected. Like it looks good, but the beams are put together all wrong or something. So those are sort of different questions. And that's, I guess, without having your personal experts, what you're sort of relying on the journals and their process to do for you, whether or not that's happening reliably, who knows, but.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think we all have experts. You don't need to have these people on speed dial. You have experts in a parasocial sense, right? Because I will listen to, for instance, what Josh Farkas will have to say about a major research trial, and we'll find all sorts of insights into the methodology. Josh is more in depth on the methodological assessment of papers in critical care than I will ever be. And I have other friends as well that even if I never met them, just listening to their stuff or reading what they put out there is going to give me insight into the methodological flaws or pluses of any individual paper. So that's the vetting I'm talking about. Now, look, if you have a buddy in your department or in your group who just happens to be a methodologist or, you know, has that same skill set, then by all means say, hey, what do you think about X paper? And then you can get a more personalized form. But we could get that information even if we don't have a stats gal or stats guy on speed dial.
Well, this kind of transitions us into the next way of coming to knowledge, which would be to basically ask experts. And I think this comes up in any situation in life where we're just not, it's not practical for us to, you know, find the answers ourselves. We ask somebody who we think we would know. And basically, instead of pursuing knowledge ourselves, we're pursuing people that we think are trustworthy and then just doing whatever they say. Some authority, expert, knowledgeable person, maybe a group or society or a journal or talking head on CNN. I mean, somebody who we think knows better than we do. But then we have the question of who do we choose to listen to? And I think the challenge that we're reaching now is it used to be at least somewhat the case that if somebody sounded right, meaning they presented themselves well, whether speaking or writing, they were sort of charismatic and it sounded compelling, often they were right, or at least they were in the ballpark of right. They had a reasonable take. If it sounded convincing, it was worth listening to, whether that was, you know, an author, a speaker, a podcaster, a blogger. That was a reasonable tool for deciding who to listen to. But I think that's become less and less true. And I don't know why that is. I think it's become easier to have a platform, this sort of democratization for anyone can start a podcast or a Twitter account, or they can have a show on TV or whatever. And it's easier than ever to sound or look or seem compelling, even if that's just something you're good at being. You're just a compelling person. You're charismatic. And the link between that and reliable knowledge has become very weak. And so I don't know if we're any good anymore at parsing out who's a good expert to listen to, especially because I think a lot of these platforms for people in the modern world have incentives built in that are not in support of truth. People are incentivized to have takes that are interesting, controversial, even wrong in some cases, because that is what gets attention. That's what builds an audience. Whereas being right is often sort of dull. It's people who are right and the truth is sort of boring is not so compelling. And I feel like especially maybe COVID was a big turning point for all this when we really in medicine saw a lot of it. Authorities who really emerged as sort of thought leaders just because they seemed like smart people. And if they're smart or good in some ways, then they must be right about other things, like knowledge is just like a global idea. And that sort of seems right to all of us. And so now I'm not sure how to figure out anymore who to listen to. And I'm not sure any of us really knows that. I kind of just want to turn to the most traditional authorities, like, you know, well, the New England Journal, at least they have an office, you know, they have payrolls. There's probably some truth to stuff they have, or, you know, whatever. And here we are on a podcast talking the same stuff. I mean, we're not giving any compelling reason to believe any of what we're saying, except that, you know, we're stringing thoughts together pretty coherently. Mm-hmm. So I don't really know how to address this anymore in any sector of life, but certainly not in medicine. I mean, I can pop anything up on the internet right now, get an answer to a question, and I have no idea if it's true other than if, like, it's grammatically correct, but anyone can do that now.
You know, the only thing I take issue with what you said is the assertion that it suddenly has changed. It's been like this forever. The only difference is that it's easier to spread that potentially dangerous message further afield. And that's certainly changed since COVID. But you never could trust people based on the signals you get from their degree of confidence, their charisma, and all of that. In fact, there's a podcast called Decoding the Gurus, which is wonderful. It's two academics. They actually go through the scientific-based gurus out there, you know, your Ubermans and what have you, and they look at the actual traits that these people display that leads to an enormous amount of audience gaining. And you find that actual scientific knowledge is not in any way primary on that stuff. It is things like you mentioned, charisma, confidence, capability of making broad-based assertions that don't give the wiggle room we want in science. In fact, hedging, which is, you know, the mark of a truth teller. You know, a truth teller hedges in science because there are no absolutes. We have, you know, the probability is pretty good that, or, you know, except for this new piece of research that kind of erodes our assurance to some extent. That's what you want to hear. Those weasel words, you know, quote unquote, are the mark of a truth teller. That's not
science is probably negatively associated with like a compelling message.
Yeah. Exactly. Exactly. And especially critical care. I mean, there's so few things we have absolute assurance of. So I hear you. You can't actually just go by, wow, this person has the limb of authority about them. I guess we could just trust what they say. But by that same token, you know, the traditional bulwarks against bad information, like the New England Journal, has really led us astray numerous times. They have a whole bunch of associations and financial relationships that make me leery of a lot of what they say. So, you know, I don't think there is a clear, oh, I could just go to this source and not have to worry. So you have to start having some epistemological, foundational ways of interacting with the world. And, you know, first off is to seek disconfirmation. I think that's a big one. So there's so much information out there that if you already believe something, you could find, you know, hours of things to read or listen to that will absolutely prop up the belief you already have. That's not going to be utile. You want to spend a good amount of time seeking out disconfirming information. So if you believe X, find someone who believes Y, and then listen to their arguments, and then see if they hold water. And that exercise, even if those people are not necessarily spouting truth, will strengthen your assurance on what you believe if you look at their arguments and find them specious, right?
And you have to very actively look for that stuff because especially nowadays, some of these AI models and things, the world is really trying to feed you confirming information. Mm-hmm. You know, a good example, if you you go to buy something, you look at the reviews, you know, there's 100,000 positive reviews for everything. Ignore them all. Look for the negative ones. That's probably a real person. And then if their negatives are relevant to you, that's useful. All the people saying, oh, I loved it. I don't know. Are they real people? Are they just thoughtless people? Are they people who got lucky? It doesn't really matter.
Well, and I think we see this outside of medicine, right? This is the problem with the world right now that we're in, is everyone lives in their little echo chambers where they only hear what they already believe. They only listen to people who agree with them. And you're right. Like, you can find anybody who will back up what you say. That may or may not be helpful.
Yeah, absolutely. And then you should be able to make the argument against whatever you believe is truth more strongly, more assertively, and with a demonstration of the extent evidence. You should be able to do that better than someone who is arguing against your point. When you can make your opponent's arguments better than they can, then you're at the point to really assert something. You should be able to have foreseen, well, here's the things they're going to say against what I believe to be true in the world, and then here's all the reasons they're incorrect. And you should be able to state it more persuasively and assertively than they can, and then tear those arguments down. And at that point, you could really assert truth. You have a high degree of sense that what you believe is true in the world because you've actually approached all of the countervailing viewpoints. And if you can't do that, then you really should not strongly assert a belief.
Yeah, you know, when you're trying to address this question of like disagreement and why there's different takes on something, you know, this often comes up, I think, trying to integrate your own clinical experience into some, you know, there's a new paper or some new perspective or expert that you don't agree with. And there's always that, you know, ego defense knee jerk of saying, well, they're just wrong or they're crazy or something. And the most powerful thing, I think, is to really step back and try instead to have a curiosity about where this different perspective is coming from. Because it is a very safe assumption that if some reasonable seeming human being has a different take, or someone did a whole study that had a different conclusion of what you think, it is true in some way. It's obviously different from your truth, but then the question is why? What's the difference in the patience, in the approach, in how they're going about things? Because now you can start to understand the larger truth and the different ways of going about it. But if your first response is, oh, this person is like the Joker, they're just anti-truth, they're like out to just, that's obviously not true, except in the most niche circumstances.
Yeah, I have a buddy who has been on the podcast a few times now. And his main role in my life is I will have something that I would say, like, I believe at a high probability. And he will inevitably write me an email saying the complete opposite. And my knee-jerk response is always, what the fuck are you talking about? And every time when I actually think about what he has said and actually reread the comments he has made, he always has a true, insightful reason to disagree with what I'm saying. And a lot of times I still retain my belief. You know, I look through his arguments and I figure his viewpoint, I could see where he's coming from, but I still feel what I feel to be correct. And it makes my view so much stronger because now all of a sudden, you know, it's been really acid tested by a very intelligent person. And then sometimes he'll write me and I'll completely have to change my viewpoint on something because he's absolutely right. I never thought about it that way. And he's actually made my grasping of truth in the world stronger. He's modified.
You go from what the fuck are you talking about to what the fuck are you talking about?
Yeah, yeah. I love that. That's exactly it.
We were just talking about this the other day, and one of our surgeons came and explained something to us. And I was like, oh, okay, well, that makes sense. I mean, I don't agree with you, but it makes sense. And I think too often we just sort of take people that we don't agree with and we write them off as they're just wrong. You know, I used to work with a cardiac surgeon who he did things this way, and everybody was like, he's just stuck in the 90s. That's how we used to do things. We don't do things like that anymore. And, you know, when I was a student, I rotated with him and we were in a case in the OR where we're just, you know, standing around waiting for the heart to restart. And, you know, we'd sort of run out of polite conversation. And so I just said, hey, what's your deal with, you know, and asked him, and he kind of laughed and explained it. And I was like, you know, he has a really valid rationale. He's not just stuck in the 90s, not just an old guy. He really knows what he's doing. Now, did that change my approach? Do I follow his way of thinking now? No, I don't. But it really helped. I think, like you're saying, Scott, it really helped me clarify why do I believe what I believe, and also understanding that this is a smart guy who has a legitimate rationale behind his decision. I might not agree with his rationale, but it's not wrong.
Yeah, you know, it's so funny you mentioned cardiac surgeons because I've had a lot of these, in my mind, epistemological discussions with cardiac surgeons. They're an interesting breed. And for the most part, and this is just a generalization, a lot of them are not on the cutting edge of evidence, but they have an enormous amount of clinical experience. And, you know, I've had debates with cardiac surgeons where they've tried to convince me that the right thing to do for the patients we're sharing, you know, I have them as the ICU doctor and they had them as the surgeons, is to start a patient on dopamine, which I, if I had my druthers, would just eliminate from the armamentarium of medicine. And I could show them all the evidence in the world. And what they're going to tell me is, look, I had patients even, you know, 3 weeks ago who, you know, I gave them this and this is what happened. And I'm completely convinced it's from the dopamine. And, you know, that is a true philosophical question. What are we going to do with that? Because I could show them the papers, but the papers are not the individual patient in front of them. And they have a wealth of anecdotal knowledge. And more than me in this regard, because I don't use dopamine. So what do you do with a question like that? And a lot of times you could try to come to a happy agreement between you. But it does bear out a lot of where the friction comes in medicine, because we feel that papers and evidence are stronger, but they never really pertain to the exact question in front of you, right? There's always a slight variant. There's always a little bit of difference. And so when does clinical knowledge trump evidence-based medicine. And I shouldn't even say that because all the real EBM people will tell you that the individual patient in front of you, their unique specifications are an absolute bedrock part of evidence-based medicine. So I will revise and say, when does clinical knowledge trump the primary research in the literature? And that question is not easily answered sometimes.
Yeah. And I mean, really, if you're trying to account for both things, you'll see there is often overlap, even those disagreements. You know, you could say, well, according to the literature in this patient, you know, if we put them on dopamine, they'll have double the chance of having a tachyarrhythmia. And they say, well, I've never seen that. Well, you know, double the chance may mean 2% chance instead of 1% chance. So it's still a very rare thing. So that kind of gives you a perspective that can be true, even if, you know, both things are. But I think the other aspect is to try to recognize when our psychology is likely to put too much weight on certain factors. And clinical experience is an example. I mean, if you see a horrible complication of a drug, it doesn't matter if all the studies people show you, you're going to spend the rest of your life thinking this is like a horrible thing because you have emotion associated with it. And the other example that I increasingly has come in mind for me is in the realm of educators and creators, like on this show, it's the psychological tendency on our part to start saying things that are more compelling to a larger audience is very difficult the larger an audience you get, because it is appealing to have listeners, viewers, followers, whatever your platform is. It may have an actual commercial reward for you, people who can make a living on saying things. And that is very rarely saying things that are true but less compelling, as we've been talking about. Mm-hmm. So to start to say, as you're the thoughtful, evidence-based educator, and this is probably true in any even bedside teaching, but especially if you're creating for a larger audience like this, if that's your goal, and to start to recognize this little voice in your head when you say something that's a little edgy, and then a lot of people listen to you. And you're like, well, that was sort of interesting. Maybe I'll keep being a little edgy. And then you kind of start to drift down a rabbit hole where what you're talking about is less and less inspired by pedagogy and more about, you know, being edgy. Because I think there are a large number of great scientists and clinicians in every field who we've sort of lost from the realm of practical science and medicine to that world. And maybe they're happy doing whatever they're doing now. But the example I sometimes bring up, and I mean, I don't like name names, but just to make it practical, was Paul Merrick, who was a great figure in critical care and was a great scientist and published a tremendous amount of the, you know, needle moving literature in the field. And then in my mind was attracted to being the different voice in critical care so much that being a different voice became more compelling than sticking to what the evidence dictated. I don't think he wanted to be famous or be on TV, but I think just being different is sometimes a draw, and that can be true at the bedside. If you're the guy who will like be a little different or crazy, I mean that can be your personality too. So these are all like psychological pulls that are we're all sort of at risk of being caught on these hooks, I think, rather than just being that boring middle of the road person who just is kind of only gently nudged in different ways by the literature and is trying to listen to all voices and all that.
Yeah, I mean, this is something we wrestle with on Amacrit, because we're iconoclastic. You know, both Josh and I on the show are really pushing the cutting edge, and we're not doing that, you know, because we were audience captured, I think, because we were doing it from the very beginning. In fact, I'd say we got more conservative, at least me. I don't know. I'm not going to evaluate Josh's work. I'll let him do that himself. But I think I'm more conservative now than when I started, only because, not that I've changed my value set, but because I think emergency medicine critical care has caught up. You know, the things that I viewed as, you know, really cutting edge back then are now accepted de rigueur standards in the practice. So, you know, there's, and I'm not looking for new crazy things, but the key moves I think I made that were protective is, first of all, I will do nothing facing the public. As soon as you face the public, audience capture becomes really dangerous because now you're not talking about, you know, a small microcosm of the population. You're talking about unlimited capability of expansion, right? So that's a big problem. And then MCRIT has always been my practice. As soon as I would shift the mindset to here is the practice, you know, I'm not doing clinical guidelines. If I was doing that, there's some danger because the shit I do would not be appropriate for most clinical guidelines. Like, you know, we have even on MCRIT, we have warning signs for, you know, this is cutting edge. This requires a level of expertise. Maybe you shouldn't do it. But from the very beginning, MCRIT has been, here's how I practice ED critical care. I'm not saying you should. And in fact, a lot of times you shouldn't, but this is what I'm doing. And I've always viewed that, perhaps delusionally, as a safety net against that expansion to, you know, we had someone who on Instagram just decried that sympathetic crashing acute pulmonary edema is, you know, completely misnamed, mismanaged. We're idiots in emergency medicine to think the way we do. And, you know, 99% of my soul says they were just doing that because they're going to get clicks. They're going to get people listening. And, you know, that's one way to play. I don't think it has longevity. I don't think, you know, that flash in the pan type stuff might play in terms of Instagram or TikTok numbers, but those don't translate to having a lasting audience that wants to hear your thoughts on medicine is my thought.
So I think the last method we have to think about is AI, because this has become a really increasingly used tool by everyone, but especially among probably younger clinicians who, you know, are more growing up with this as something that's part of the world. They don't have to adapt to it. And I think of the tools as they exist now, we're seeing a lot of the same problems just multiplied because everything that comes out of these AI agents sounds convincing. Mm-hmm. That is built, they are the ultimate BSers. So the whole idea of assessing whether something sounds good, therefore is out the door. Anything that comes out of these things is going to sound about right. And then they seem to be good tools for summarizing things on a high level. I like to think of them in many ways like when you would answer a question by like popping it into Google and then skimming the results. Because essentially that's what they did. They read the internet and they're summarizing it for you. And so in that sense, sure, because how good was I at that? I mean, how long was I spending? You know, have I been getting past the first Google page? Probably not. If I see two or three things that sort of say the same thing, that's probably the message. So, all right, so maybe that's what it's telling me. But, you know, compared to some of these other tools like textbooks or reviews or UpToDate, you know, which may be a waning tool, but it, you know, was a very popular one. At least those were all someone's opinion. Like we're talking about, this is how I practice. That was a traditional way you learn medicine at the bedside. Whereas if I ask whatever, ChatGPT or Open Evidence or one of these things, it's nobody's opinion. It's just sort of words that sound right. So, you know, it's at best kind of a gestalt of the internet's opinion. And it's just kind of an opaque process. So there's no way of digging into the methodology at all. Now some of the tools will at least give you some references, but it's not like here are all the sources it used to come to this conclusion. I am not sure what to do with all of these. What is especially being left out, of course, is any reference to personal experience, because these tools have no clinical experience. So all of the knowledge that is incorporated into your decision-making based on your experience will not come up here unless somebody has written those things in a way that these sources can read. But all the, you know, kind of tacit knowledge on those practical things, like you're talking about the CT surgeons, unless that person has written the biography of their life with all the lessons they've learned, that knowledge is not in the cloud out there. So maybe that's one of the big things that's missing. But certainly we probably can't avoid these tools. They're only going to be growing. I mean, what do you see being their application, you know, maybe now and then in the future?
Yeah, well, even now, if you go in and just ask ChatGPT a question, you know, it's dealer's choice whether you're going to get a answer that is legitimate or not. I found it's pretty good in medicine compared to some other walks of life in terms of its delusion rate. The delusions are pretty low, probably because we have such an enormous body of really AI perfect knowledge in the form of foam in emergency medicine and critical care that it's eating.
We all built the training database for it.
AI. But that being said, I don't think you should be using it that way. I think you should say, do a search of primary sources. Please cite those primary sources and give me an answer. And then when it gives you the answer, don't take the answer. Read the primary sources. As a medical librarian, these tools right now are immensely powerful. They can find it. And what they're essentially doing is, instead of like searching all of PubMed and like going through that, they're searching the foam sites, picking out the primary literature cited there and giving it to you. That's not bad. Now, you know, you have a risk of missing a major paper that really invalidates a lot of what it's saying just because it hasn't been covered in a form that it's digested. But you're going to get something pretty good, probably better than you're going to get doing your own PubMed search. So anything you're doing as a PubMed search to find an answer, I think that's kind of dead. If you're just asking ChatGPT, hey, here's this patient's, you know, vital signs and presentation, tell me what I should actually order and do. Yeah, that's a little bit worrisome. And I'd be a little scared of that. But that being said, if what you're doing is, there's a constellation of signs and symptoms here, and I really don't know, it might be worth sticking that into ChatGPT, not to take their answer as gospel, but because they will suggest things.
Ideas,
that
yeah.
might not have hit you, and then you're right. Like, oh my God, yes, that's it.
Should have thought
you know,
of
that. Using your own vetting of clinical knowledge, like, you know, oh my God, cavernous sinus thrombosis, I totally blanked on that, you know, in this headache, but it picked it up. And machine learning is better at that stuff than we are. That's why you could look at machine learning for ECGs, and all of a sudden, with no foreshadowing to the inventors, it's predicting heart failure. So there are ECG signs of heart failure on your standard 12 leads that machine learning is capable of picking up on. It's a black box. We have no idea what it's actually looking at. And if we did, it's probably so many disparate, tiny, tiny variables that we wouldn't even be able to do it as humans. But all of a sudden, with a high degree of accuracy, you could diagnose heart failure from an ECG. That's kind of crazy. And it translates to the same thing. There might be like 26 little suggestions in a patient's presentation that you would never put together as aortic dissection, that all of a sudden the machine's like, oh, that's aortic dissection. You're like, really? And then you think about it, you're like, well, I guess they do have, you know, this weird kind of, I guess I'll scan them and you find an aortic dissection. That I think is going to be immensely powerful. But if you're just asking, hey, what do I do to treat blank? And you're not vetting those sources, I think you're, at least right now, sending yourself astray.
Yeah, I mean, it's dependent on the data that it collected and can access. So if your constellation is built on, you know, things that you see at the bedside, it doesn't have access to a lot of that, nor did it have access to a lot of that data in the literature, unless it was codified into data points. If it's like your gestalt at the bed, I mean, it doesn't have any of that stuff. And that's partly why it's probably going to have suggestions that you don't think are any good. But as an idea generator, and you can skim them, I mean, they're expert pattern recognizers. So yes. Like the med student who memorizes all the bullet points, it remembers all the bullet points, which you probably don't. So as a kind of combined tool, the question is going to be when, if it gets better and better to where it has ideas that you don't think are good, but it ends up being more right than you, which probably will eventually be true. But the other challenge, I think, is that a lot of these tools now are still very built to be agreeable. So there is a great deal of that confirmation bias there. So if you ever ask questions about that, ask like, is this right? They're going to be like, absolutely. So like you said, maybe your approach should be trying to disconfirm your beliefs and say, you know, convince me otherwise. Tell me what else it could be. Tell me I'm that kind of thing, and really kind of prompt it to fight its own tendency and, of course, your tendency to just roll with what you already think.
The vast majority of my interactions with these models is tell me where I'm wrong in an assertion I'm making, rather than, you know, convince me that I'm right. It, just as you said, Brendan.
It's like arguing with the internet, which has always been sort of a life-shortening activity. And yet that's what it was good for. It was, you can find a whole bunch of people to tell you you're an idiot, and you'll come out with a broader understanding of the world and also a bit of alcoholism. But like, you go argue with ChatGPT instead, and then...
There's an eponymous law that I found to be true, which is if you want the most right answer on the internet, deliberately say the wrong answer. And very rapidly, you will be given the correction that you're looking for.
Oh, all right. Scott, what else? How can we all just do a little better knowing things these days? Because I only see this becoming more challenging. It's not that there's a lack of information or people to tell you things. It's that there's too much of it. And I don't know that we've gotten any better at interpreting or parsing it than we were 100 years ago. Probably we're worse.
I mean, this is not going to really be related to the most current technology, but I still think it's the best things we could be doing is, first of all, don't speak in sureties. When you're talking to other clinicians, when you're teaching, just speak in levels of probability, or just add in that wiggle room of, you know, I've always thought, but I could be wrong, or, you know, my current degree of assurance on this, you know, is somewhere in the 80% range. You know, give that space for people you're interacting with or teaching to be able to assert differing opinions. If you have a position of authority, or you're just a teacher, which automatically puts you in a position of authority, you say, here's how it is, you're really creating epistemic closure on the parts of your learners. Either now they're going to go, and you see this all the time, well, why do you believe that's true? Well, my chief resident told it to me on my surgery rotation 20 years ago. And you know, that kind of closure is really dangerous. And then, you know, actually taking that a step further, and you know, Annie Duke's work of thinking in bets is a great way to go. And now you're constantly adjusting Bayesian probabilities. You know, you go in with a level of assertion before looking at new evidence, so that you're constantly updating that, rather than, oh, you know, I epi's bad. Oh no, now epi's good. Now epi's bad again, right? That's not how it works. It's like, all right, I have a 50% shot that epi's doing anything. Now this new paper says it's good, but there's so much other that's saying it's bad. All right, maybe I'm at 55% now that epi's good. That's really how you should be playing. And if you have that as a philosophy, it's going to allow you to interact with all of these new sources in a much safer way, I think.
Well, it avoids the closure for yourself too, because if you say this is the truth, then how do you ever backtrack on that? Right? Like, even if you do want to change your mind, you'll be like, well, I'm the guy who said that this is the truth. I just told everyone I can't be wrong. I'm going to look like an idiot. And also in your own mind, you if that's the truth you built, you can't. So if you also believe that, I don't know, but this is sort of where I'm at now, but it can change tomorrow, then, you know, everyone can keep shifting with the tide. Mm-hmm. Brian, what else?
Oh, man, this is really good. I think about all the sorts of things like this and all the biases that we have. And I think, you know, as you were talking about this, I thought about my grandmother when I was a kid always argued that, you know, well, they say this causes cancer, now they say that causes cancer, so I'm going to keep smoking. And basically, she's just looking for a justification to keep smoking, right? And she's using the scientists don't know what they're talking about because they think everything causes cancer anyway. The other thing I think about is, and I think this is something that I'm hearing more and more from younger clinicians, is either extremely dogmatic, right? A study came out that showed this, and so this is the final answer. And if you disagree with me, you are wrong. Or people who say, I don't know, I'm just going to give up because
nihilism.
There's so many studies that come out, and you know, they hear stuff like this in this discussion and go, well, you know, I felt good about it an hour ago because I would just read the New England Journal or I'd read JAMA and I would just believe what they said. You know, one of the very first medical lectures I ever went to was a guy who took a study from JAMA and a study from the New England Journal, picked them apart, and at the end of the lecture, we were all convinced that they were the most worthless studies ever written, and they're published in the two of the most prestigious journals. And I thought, well, who do I believe, right? You know, and especially in critical care, we have all these studies with low numbers, frankly, right? We're not cardiology. We're not doing 20,000 patient studies. And we're also looking at endpoints like, did they die? I don't know. I mean, 50% of the patients in the ICU are going to live no matter what we do, right? It's just how this works. So then you just kind of go, I don't know, should we listen to anything? Are any of these studies valuable?
It's a problem. I mean, RCTs are high up on our evidence chain. And when you look at how many single center RCTs in critical care actually validate, the number was like 1 out of 20. Yeah. So 20 of, like, we're not talking observational trials here. We're talking randomized controlled trials. 1 in 20 actually are true. That can lead to some degree of nihilism. I think what you have to do is for the commonly occurring presentations in your neck of the woods, you have to come to just some, here's how I'm going to handle it, barring new evidence. And you could vet that with buddies you think are smart. You could even come up with, you know, for your critical care group, here's the way we do things, which gives a lot more safety, even if it's not, you know, truth in the world. It's as close as we could come to it at this moment. And then you just play with those until you have new evidence emerge. And then for the things that aren't common, well, then you just have to find sources that you could trust. But the common things are common, so it means for most of the time, you're not going to be in this epistemic state of internal disarray. You're going to be happy for the most part. We worked it out. Here's our internal mental guidelines for how to handle weaning, how to handle nutrition. And so you're left with 95% of the time, you're kind of operating on autopilot, which is the safest way to operate in clinical medicine, as long as that autopilot is set right, calibrated right to the best available evidence. And 5% of the time, you have to do a lot of thinking. That keeps it interesting. That means you're learning new things. And if you come to the point of something in that 5%, you're like, oh, I feel pretty good about how we handle this thyroid storm at this point. Maybe it becomes a new internal guideline that you're going to use, even though it's not as common a thing. And that's a healthy and enjoyable way to practice medicine, in my estimation.
Yeah. The other thing I was reflecting on, which I don't think we mentioned, is, you know, as you go out and you hear different ideas from different places and you're trying to understand how to apply them to yourself, if you just view them all as ideas, kind of this big marketplace of ideas, and you can take with the ones that seem relevant to you and sound useful and pertinent to your practice, and that's fine. And then it actually doesn't matter what the sources are. Smart people, dumb people, bots, whatever. I mean, if a bot can come up with a perspective that is compelling to you, that it doesn't really matter if anyone, it's anyone's opinion. If you're expecting any of these to be better than others, that's getting harder and harder because I don't know who has a better or worse take. They may have their own take. This is how I practice. And if they're very experienced, it's worth listening to. But again, you know, is the 30-year, you know, senior cardiac surgeon have a better take than someone more junior? I mean, it's different. But the one thing that I think is no longer very useful is the idea of sort of voting ideas and saying, well, if I hear a take from a lot of people, it's more likely to be true. Because the world that we're living in now is one that numbers are more and more artificial. You know, if I Google something, I can get 100,000 pages saying the same thing that all might have been generated the moment I searched. Like maybe nobody thought those. There, you can now have podcasts that are automatically generated. It is so easy to create reasonable sounding opinions that hearing something from a lot of places probably doesn't mean much at all anymore. So like qualitatively, you know, using different perspectives to add to your life, sure. Quantitatively, I don't think so anymore.
Yeah, I see where you're going. And, you know, a lot of it is propagated from like one source of information is the source for, you know, countless other sources of information.
Like the paper that cites the paper that cites the paper is all from the same paper.
Yeah. And it's so much worse in the news now because we don't have the primary news gathering that we used to have. We don't have the numbers of that. There's like basically two or three news services and maybe, you know, a handful of papers that are going to field their own independent journalism. And then the rest are just sucking up those original sources. So you could have like 500 papers in the US saying a piece of news, but it all stems from just Reuters or one other news gathering source. Yeah, it's a definite problem that you're alluding to, Brendan.
All right. Well, we'll let you go. Thanks for helping us out with this. I hope everyone kind of applies these same ideas to this own show as with anything else you listen to, meaning interesting concepts, see how they're relevant to you, go try to explore some others, especially ones that maybe have a different take, and see what they can add to your life. And just go about collecting concepts with a bit of a jaundiced eye. Understand that there is kind of not going to be one source of truth for probably anything ever again, but you got to figure out how to you know, make your own practice work in a reasonably safe way. Find some authorities that you think are worth listening to, but don't trust them for everything. Try to have some ability to address the literature. So when you really need an answer that is not biased by anything, you can at least look at it, and how deeply you can do that will vary. But you have at least some link to truth, even if it's a foggy one. You're not completely dependent on what you're fed from elsewhere. And then beyond that, who can say where we'll be in a few years? All right, Scott. Talk to you next time.
Thank you.